Our prelude is En Prière by Fauret. Finally, a language that I kind of know a little bit of, performed by Amber. And Amber, let me wait till I can...
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Alice Mant. My pronouns are she, hers, hers. And I'm the Director of Religious Exploration here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender identity, family structure, age, or abilities. Since we don't have our name tags on, we'd like to invite you to add your pronouns to your name in Zoom. Introducing yourself with your pronouns is a great way to challenge the norm that these should be assumed and to create space for everyone, no matter how they identify. Click on your picture, press the three dots in the upper right, and click on Rename to add your pronouns. We have a few announcements. See the order of service available via a link in our weekly newsletter for additional events. We are sharing our offering this quarter with the Tenet Resource Center, which is dedicated to promoting positive relationships between rental housing consumers, tenants, and providers, landlords, by providing information and referrals, education about rental rights and responsibilities, and access to conflict resolution. The study group continues in February. Prairie's study group will meet via Zoom the second Monday in February, February 14th, to discuss the book Behind the Kitchen Door by Saru Jaraman, led by Katrina Thompson. Finally, the nominating committee would like to announce that they have several important positions to fill and will be actively recruiting members to fill these roles in the coming weeks and months. Next is the opening song, We're Going to Be Friends by Jack White, performed by Jack Johnson.
Fall is here, hear the yell. Back to school, ring the bell. Brand new shoes, walking blues. Climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Walk with me, Susie Lee, through the park and by the tree. We can rest upon the ground and look at all the bugs we found. Safely walk to school without a sound. We safely walk to school without a sound. Well, here we are, no one else. We walk to school all by ourselves. There's dirt on our uniforms from chasing all the ants and worms. We clean up and now it's time to learn. We clean up and now it's time to learn. Numbers, letters, learn to spell. Nouns and books and show and tell. Playtime, we will throw the ball. Then back to class, through the hall. Teacher marks our height against the wall. The teacher marks our height against the wall. We don't notice any time pass, 'cause we don't notice anything. We sit side by side in every class. The teacher thinks that I sound funny, but she likes it when you sing. Tonight I'll dream in my bed while silly thoughts run through my head of the bugs in alphabet. And when I wake tomorrow, I'll bet you and I will walk together again. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Next, Holly Tillander will read The Chalice Lighting by Nelson Mandela.
Okay. Education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. We light this chalice as a symbol of our gathered community and the divine spark within each of us. And now we'll take a moment for our silent meditation. All right. This is the part where I start, Alice.
Today's, well, I can give you a little intro. Today's service is The Kids Scare You and Other Uncomfortable Truths About Education in America by Holly Tillander. Her pronouns are she, her. Holly Tillander views education as her calling. She holds a BA in elementary education, an MA in bilingual and multicultural education, and is working on her second MA in deaf education. She has worked as an educator in varied settings, including the Director of Religious Education at Prairie UU. Passionate about education reform, she serves on her local school board and centers her advocacy on equity, innovation, and wellness. Today's presentation relates to our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
Hey, so hi, everybody. It's really good to see you all again. It's been a really long time. From the introduction, please know that it's not because I don't miss you or think about you. It is because being back in grad school at 45 years old is taxing, to say the least. So, I am really enjoying all that I'm learning. I'm looking at education from a completely different viewpoint now. You know, as an ESL teacher, I always worked with students who were dealing with limited access, and I'm still doing that, just in a very different way. So I do miss all of you, but I am really loving this new journey that I'm on. So I'm going to share my screen. But you're all muted, so if you're complaining, I don't hear it. Okay. All right. So today, the title of what we're going to be talking about today is The Kids Scare You and Other Truths. And we're going to just start off with the fact that the kids do scare us. They scare me too. I've been doing this for almost 20 years and kids still scare me. But I'm doing it anyway. And I hope that after today's presentation, you'll feel a little more interested in getting into the ring and thinking about how you might participate. You know, we're here because Renee reached out. There's an interest in understanding how kids are doing, right? How kids are doing after the pandemic, how they're doing with the state of the world, which, you know, is stressful and anxiety producing to most adults I know. I have two teenagers, and I can speak from my perspective that the state of the world is taxing and stressful to them in a way that I don't fully understand. I didn't face this world as a teenager. So I'm constantly trying to understand their perspective, their feelings, the way that this current state that we find ourselves in is impacting them at this developmental stage. And I don't know all the answers, right? And I think that's a good place for us all to start. So let's begin with an embodied practice, if you'll indulge me for just a moment. I'm going to invite you to take a nice deep breath and find a comfortable position, however you are seated. You may wish to turn off your camera if it's not already off, if you like to really feel as if this is a private moment for you, but it's not necessary. You might consider putting both feet flat on the ground and just maybe wiggling your toes on the ground and just noticing the feel of the soles of your feet as they make contact with the surface. And maybe put your hands on your thighs. You could consider just rubbing lightly on your thighs just to feel that contact and bring yourself here into this moment. And then just take a moment to find a nice tall spine as you inhale. Nice deep inhale that goes all the way into your belly, really feeling your belly expand. And then at the base of that, pause for just a second before you begin your exhale and allow your exhale to fully complete. Sometimes we don't always let the exhale finish. And so I'm going to invite you to take three breaths like that. Nice deep inhales where the belly expands, pausing at the bottom, and then a long, slow exhale, almost as if blowing out candles until all the air is gone. And then doing that one more time in your own way, feeling your elbows hanging heavily under your shoulders, just feeling the weight of your body and the support beneath you. Then coming back to your regular breath whenever you're ready. And from this place of calm, I'm going to ask you all a question you've probably asked many, many children. Maybe people asked you when you were a child. And that question is, who is or was your favorite teacher? And I just want you to take a second and think about that. And don't overthink it. Just, you might have a Rolodex of wonderful teachers. That's awesome. But let that file spin until one rises to the top. And keep that nice soft breathing going as you just allow your mind to explore that person and what made them so wonderful, or why they rose to the top in this question, what made them different than maybe some of the other wonderful teachers you've had, or what did they give you that you try to give to others or that you keep close? And just really maybe even have a moment of gratitude. Reflect on how that person may have changed your life in some way. And if you're willing, I'd like to invite maybe up to three people to share briefly about somebody. I always love to hear about favorite teachers. So you can raise your real hand if you like, or you can raise your fake hand, your little yellow hand. And
I see Kent has his virtual hand up.
All right, go ahead, Kent.
So I've got several, but I guess I was fortunate in that way, but maybe the one who stands out most is my first grade teacher, who was Mrs. Pollard. I probably never knew her first name, but she really put in a lot of work to make me not go crazy in first grade, because she recognized that I was incredibly bored by the standard math. So she essentially made up an entire math curriculum for me from scratch. So I kind of got like first, second, and third grade all in first grade because she like just did that. So that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I'm hearing that she was somebody who was aware and willing to innovate. Those are some amazing teacher qualities. Anybody else want to share?
I'll do one real quick. I had a calculus teacher named Mr. Rose, and calculus, for anyone that's taken it, can be real challenging. I actually dropped out of the original and had to go back to pre-calc, and then the next year I did calculus, I think it's AB. And it was really, really challenging. I loved it. I ended up loving it, but I hated it in the beginning because I was not doing well. So I came like before school, I swear almost every day to his room and went through the homework that I didn't understand. And he was always really receptive to students coming before or after school and trying to get the questions. And if he was explaining it one way and I didn't get it, then he'd try to explain it a different way, which was really nice because I've had teachers that said, well, that's the way. So I don't know how else to explain it to you. And they don't give you any other way to try to understand it. And I ended up getting like, I think I aced or almost aced my final. I mean, I got like an A+ in that class. And I was so, and then he'd write notes on the test that I was doing well on. And he'd say like, great job. And like, you did it. And I was so happy that after that hard work, and now having been a teacher, I know that the students were interrupting his planning time, right? From becoming before and after school. That was like precious teacher planning time. But I think it's so gracious that he allowed students to come who were trying to get help and do better in the subject. So that really stands out in my mind.
Yeah. So I'm hearing that he was dedicated, but also sounds like he had that gold standard of math teachers, which is where he didn't have just one way to explain things. One thing that I found as a math teacher myself is that I think it's always easier to teach something that was harder for you to learn, right? Because if something was easy for you to learn, you're kind of like, why don't you get this? Whereas if it was hard and tricky, you know, challenging for you to learn, you've got a bag of tricks you can pull out of. Okay. How about Paula? Hi, Paula.
One of my favorite teachers was a coach that I had in community college. And she taught several sports, and I had not had much opportunity to be in sports, although I loved to play them when I was younger. So I joined like every team there was, including the basketball team, where I had had my heart broken. I'd never been able really to learn the game or play the game, but she let me on the team. I did the practices with everybody. I got to be the manager, where you do those little circles and crosses about where they are. They tried the basket. And on our very last game, she called me and she said, okay, Pachars, you're in. And I was terrified. I did not do well, but it was just so great of her to include me and to, you know, let me know that you can always learn and you can always be part of the team and that everybody has a contribution. So she was great.
I'm hearing that she was an inclusive teacher, right? And a person who was really dedicated to making sure that everybody felt like they had a place, and how impactful that was for you. That's wonderful. I will have some more time at the end to talk a little bit more about your teaching, your favorite teachers. And I hope that you, just continue to think about that and how that person impacted you and how you might take their gift and pass it on in your own way. And here is Maria Montessori. She's one of my teaching mentors. And I love this quote by her. And it's something that I really tried to embody when I was at Prairie, which is, one test of the correctness of educational procedure is the happiness of the child, right? I mean, we can force them to do a lot of things, but we no longer need to gather and study research to know that if kids aren't safe, happy, and well, it doesn't matter what amazing curriculum we have or how many master's degrees we have or what it does. Nothing matters at all, because that's not a conducive learning experience if you're not well. Okay, so here we are. Truth number one, kids are scary. And I'm saying that's my truth as well. Okay. I still, I'm scared by children, my own and others. They're completely unpredictable. You have no idea what they're going to do. They have no filter. They're demanding. They have no life experience to draw from. And so they do completely ridiculous and inexcusable things, and we must excuse them. They don't care about us, and they really shouldn't, right? That's not a developmentally appropriate thing to expect of them. They are really busy worrying about themselves, or they should be. Many of them don't. And so we must do that for them. They have their own agendas, right? And those don't always align with the agendas that we have decided are extremely important and pertinent in the moment. And they don't have any sense of consequences, right? We're constantly watching out for those for them as well. They're hard to read, and maybe even lately, particularly, it kind of seems like the rules are always changing, right? When I was a kid, there was some pretty common behavior expectations that went across school, home, church, community, right? And we all kind of knew there's a way that kids should behave, and that's the right way. And if they behave the wrong way, we're all fairly comfortable with intervening and taking care of that. And that has really changed over the last 20 to 30 years as we've gotten more aware of development. And, you know, we've seen just a broadening of kids' abilities to feel comfortable to just be kids and develop in the way that they're going to develop. That doesn't mean that they don't still need and expect guidelines and boundaries from us, but it's become, I think, for a lot of people, challenging to know where those are. And I think most people aren't interested in causing harm, but they don't necessarily know how to interact with a kid or a child in a way that does set healthy boundaries and guidelines, but also doesn't crush their autonomy or, you know, create harm. So that's the truth. The truth is that kids are scary. And I don't want to just tell you that and walk away. I want to give you a takeaway. All right. And this is your takeaway number one. I'm going to give you three takeaways today. And that is that all misbehavior or lack of progress in a kid is due to an unmet need. Always 100%. It's not because they're trying to make you angry. It's not because they want chaos, although maybe they do. It's 100% of the time because there is some unmet need that, frankly, if you're interested in helping, it's your job to figure out, because they're not going to figure it out. So where do those unmet needs come from? Some of you may have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. He was an American psychologist. He created this hierarchy of needs, and you really should, you know, in the case of a hierarchy, you start at the bottom and you build up, right? So in your work with kids, and when you find yourself being challenged by kids and freaked out by kids and thinking, man, I don't need anything to do with kids. I've done that. That's over. You might start to take a look at this hierarchy and use it as a tool to figure out where might this child be lacking something that I might be able to give them or provide. Okay. So when we start down at the bottom, it's, you know, fairly simple. Kids need air, water, food, shelter, sleep, clothing, and reproduction. Many of you are doing the work in society to create a more just and equitable society so that that's not something that we have to assume is not being met. But unfortunately, many of our children are stuck in the physiological needs base of the hierarchy of needs. They're not moving on until they have adequate food, shelter, sleep, clothing. And that's a fact, right? So that might be the first place for you to start when you're dealing with a kid who is really pressing your buttons or pushing you into that place of discomfort. Then we move up into safety needs, personal security, resources, health, property. Now, what does that mean for a kid? That means that they know that nobody's going to hurt them. Right? Emotionally or physically. It means that they know that they will be able to access what they need in the environment that they're in to keep themselves safe, and that their safety is valued and understood and recognized. Then we move into love and belonging, and that's where we get into interpersonal relationships. Do people like me? do I belong here? Do I have a part here? Would people miss me if I was gone? Is it worse when I'm here? Do people think it's worse when I'm here? Right. This is a big one for that tricky stage as they move into puberty. Right. And I personally have always said that middle school teachers earn a place in whatever comes next at the front of the line, because middle school is a very difficult place to teach, because you've got so many struggling kids really looking for that sense of connection, really looking to identify who they are and whether they belong. And maybe that's a place where you can provide that for them. Maybe you can just, as a loving presence, as a person who's, I see you, I like you, you're cool, right? Then we move into self-esteem, and that's, can they do things for themselves? Can they take action, and can it have a positive result? And this is where a lot of times in public school, kids get stuck, right? And there are many public schools that are really trying to do a good job of having appropriate interventions, multi-tiered systems of supports, systems to identify kids who are struggling. But the reality is, and this is a service for a different day, our education system hasn't changed much in the last 150 plus years. And it doesn't in many, many ways meet the needs of our students learning today. It's a very top-down model. It's not a very collaborative model. It's not set up to be that way. It's very results-driven as opposed to experience-driven, and it's difficult to individualize. And so we do get a lot of kids that struggle at that esteem place. And that's where you might consider tutoring, mentoring. But you don't have to be, a brilliant mathematician to tutor kids in math. You don't have to be a famous author to tutor kids in reading and writing, but that's a place that can be very helpful. And then we get to self-actualization, and that's really a personal work, right? That's the work they're going to do on the inside. And we can't necessarily help them do that, but we can support them in all those other layers, right? And make sure that they've found success so they can get up to the top of that hierarchy, and they can do that deep interpersonal work with the support of a loving and present community, so that we can have self-actualized students and we can start to see a drop in some of the very distressing statistics we're seeing in terms of kids' mental health and their sense of connection and their sense of hopefulness. So that's your first takeaway, right? Is all misbehavior or progress is due to a lack of an unmet need. Always 100%. It's never personal to you. It's always personal to them. Always. And if we can look at this from a place of trying to understand rather than trying to control, again, going back to that shifting idea of what it means to interact with children, we might be able to make a positive connection that will someday be the thing that moved a kid up that level, up that hierarchy, got them closer to that self-actualization piece. Okay, so that's our first truth and our first takeaway. Let's all take a nice deep breath. Letting that one fully settle. Truth number two, learning is uncomfortable. And that's okay, right? It's important, I think, for people to recognize and remember that if you are comfortable, you are not learning. Okay, you have already learned what you need in this moment. If you are comfortable, you will feel uncomfortable in the presence of the new and different. And discomfort doesn't kill anybody, right? That's another thing to remember. Discomfort indicates that learning is happening. And if you can start to think that in your mind, oh, I'm feeling really uncomfortable, there's something here for me to learn. Maybe that go back to that breath, right? I can take a deep breath. I can re-embody myself here. This discomfort is not going to kill me. What is it that's coming at me right now? What is it that I need to know that I don't already know? But the truth is that there is a such thing as too much discomfort, Okay. And for this, I'm bringing you Lev Vygotsky and his zone of proximal development. So he was a Russian psychologist who developed this learning theory called the zone of proximal development. And essentially, you know, I've got this graphic here, but essentially, if you think of three concentric circles, I think that's the right way to say it. The center circle is your comfort zone, right? That little blue circle. That's your comfort zone. That's what you can learn on your own. You're fine there, regulated, no big deal. Then you move into that middle circle, and that's called the zone of proximal development. You can think of that as your challenge zone. Okay, that's where you're feeling the discomfort. You're having to stretch a little bit, and you need a little bit of help. You notice those two rectangles there. You need the help of a more knowledgeable other. That's a, he calls it an MKO, more knowledgeable other. That's a teacher, an adult, a mentor. You might also need the help of some technology and tools. And some of those tools might even be self-regulation tools, right? Because again, learning is uncomfortable. It's inherently uncomfortable, and it's supposed to be. Then we get into that outer circle, and that on this graphic, it says beyond my reach. You can think of that as your panic zone. And I think if you take a moment, you might be able to call up a memory of a time when either you were in your panic zone or you witnessed someone in their panic zone, right? Again, coming back to the realities of public education in the United States, and because it lacks individuality, because it lacks an ability to allow students to master one level before they are pushed into the next, we often see kids in their panic zone. That manifests. That can manifest in many different ways. Some kids manifest with a ventral vagal response. Some of you may have heard of the polyvagal theory. A ventral vagal response, meaning they shut down. They get quiet. They retreat. I'm sure you've dealt with a child who's just got nothing there. They're shut down and they've got nothing for you. They might respond with moving to the front of their vagal nerve, where they may fight or flight. Right? They may argue, they may yell, they may become physical, they may swear, right? They're moving into that more active phase of panic as opposed to the shutdown phase of panic. But again, we go back to that first takeaway of misbehavior or lack of progress. We're dealing with an unmet need. And in this case, perhaps the unmet need is to be back in their challenge zone, or maybe even to retreat all the way to their comfort zone. Right? I think as adults, we often have the tendency to push, push, push. We have a goal in mind. We need to get there. And we really feel like if we just keep up a steady stream of pressure, you know, they'll come along and they'll get there. Sometimes retreat is okay. There's nothing wrong with your comfort zone. It's a good place to be. It's a good place to hang out. There's really nothing great about the panic zone. So if you want to think about it that way, it's this, not a lot of good things are happening there. Certainly not a lot of reflection, which is really important for growth. So that's Vygotsky's zone of proximal development. I often explain this to kids by drawing the three circles and writing the words comfort zone, challenge zone, panic zone. I have had great success with explaining this to kids, giving them that language to say to somebody, I'm in my panic zone, or I'm done. Right? So that's something to consider. Takeaway number two in this idea that learning is inherently uncomfortable, rupture and repair is the process. Okay. So rupture, we can think of that as the place where we kind of break out of the comfort zone. We break out of what's comfortable. We might rupture our understanding of ourselves or our understanding of some concept. And that can feel a little scary. Rupture is a scary concept, right? And we have to cycle back with repair. We have to learn to do that over and over and over. If you try like hell to avoid rupture, you know, and you don't build the skills for repair, you're not learning. And repair can be as simple as, wow, something happened. This is what it meant to me. This is what I think about it. What do you think? And then listening. Because most of the kids I've ever worked with are ready for the repair stage. They don't always get it, right? There's plenty of rupture, and they don't always get an adult who will come back and move through the repair stage with them and model what that's like, model what that self, what self-regulation that takes to acknowledge that something went off the rails or acknowledge that something didn't go well and have a conversation about it and trust that this kid in front of you is fully capable of showing up to that conversation and needs to do so. So that's takeaway number two. All right, you know what this means? Let's all take a nice deep breath. We forget to breathe so much. We forget to breathe. That's a virtual no, so no COVID germs are being shared. Okay, truth number three. Everyone's a teacher. Yes, that means you. In every single moment that you are with another person, you are teaching something. Maybe you are teaching how you want to be treated. Maybe you are teaching an important skill, or maybe you are passing along a passion of yours for somebody else to maybe get ignited by, right? But interaction involves teaching because that's it's an inherent part of interaction, right? To teach is to interact is to teach. And so I really want to, and I continuously do challenge people that I talk to all the time. Yes, we value teachers who have gone through the process and gotten the degree and are doing the work in the classroom, but every single one of those teachers wants you to know this too, that this job cannot fall solely on the men and women who bite the bullet, really, especially these days, and show up in a classroom despite how unbelievably difficult and terrifying it is these days, more than ever before. And when people say, thank goodness for teachers, thank you for the teachers, what the teachers want to say back to you is, please help us. Because every moment is a learning opportunity. Every moment is a chance to impart something to the people who are coming after you. And it's an all of us job. It's not a Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 2:30 kind of deal. It's a every moment of every day kind of deal. And that means we need you, right? The entire human history has been propelled by each of us teaching the next one whatever they need to know. And though we've kind of always disagreed about what are the most important things to know, I really believe that within each of us, we have a really good idea of something that's made a big impact on us that we want to share with somebody else. We want to explain and compart this information. From our own lived experiences, we gather grace and wisdom and insight and passion. And these things are doubled, you know, quadrupled when we share them. So it's not, this is not an invitation, you know, it's not meant to come across as another cross that you must bear. You know, I've got to recycle and I've got to vote and I've got to teach. It's just, it's not that. It's just an opportunity. I'm providing an opportunity for you to think about the fact that you are already teaching and maybe be more cognizant of how you are doing that and more intentional. So, yeah, let's come to takeaway, or let's talk about why, okay? So, and I can share this slide. Each of these links takes you to a study or a resource, but students who have a significant connection with a learning mentor report higher confidence. Confidence is something that's kids are really struggling with these days. They look out at the world and how many problems there are to solve, and they are not sure how in the world they are going to do that. And they need confidence. They need that connection. Having access to a trusted mentor or teacher lessens anxiety. We are dealing with a crisis of mental health in our youth. Anxiety and depression are being diagnosed at rates never before seen in our history. And it's a chronic problem. Students who spend time with trusted adults across multiple environments have more finely developed executive function. And this is where a program like Prairie UU RE was so instrumental for my children. We live far from a lot of our family, and my kids made many relationships in RE that we still draw upon in difficult times. We still remember. And, you know, hopefully COVID will get to the point where we can do that again and we can come together again, because it is so important. Executive function has been shown in multiple studies to be even more impactful to your academic success than your IQ. You can think of executive function as the set of skills that occur in your frontal lobe that allow you to manage your life. It falls into three main categories: working memory, impulse control, and flexible thinking. And again, that's a service for a whole nother day. Progress. Students who have access to mentors make better academic progress. That's been proven. Higher graduation rates. High school and college students who receive mentoring have higher rates of graduation. And improved social skills. This is a really big one, especially coming out of this pandemic. Kids who build a relationship with a mentor have more advanced social skills, which you might not connect to academic success, but is intrinsically connected to academic success. If kids have poor social skills, they have a really difficult time learning. So here's takeaway number three. These two statements are I have them on my wall. I make a point to say them in some form to every kid that I work with at some point, because they counteract the two most toxic assumptions that kids make all the time. And the first one is that you are not doing it wrong, right? If you did it right, you already knew it. You didn't learn it. There's no such thing as doing it wrong. There's doing it, reflecting on it, and trying again. That's it. That's life. There's no such thing as doing it wrong. You'd be amazed how many kids really do not know that, and how many kids are walking around making the constant assumption that they're always doing it wrong. And that's not because, I mean, it's in part because we aren't aware that they're thinking that way. But it's also in part, just part of their immature way of seeing the world, right? And to model back to them, no, you're not doing that wrong. That's a wonderful and amazing thing. And then the second one is there's no rush. And that's hard because we rush everywhere. Public education in particular is extremely fast-paced. It's extremely disconnected from what individual students need, and it feels very rushed. And so every opportunity you have to say to someone, there's no rush. No, don't worry about it. No, you're right where you need to be. You're right on time. Those are powerful statements, and I invite you to make a note of them so that you can say them. You can toss them out. Because they are really, if you say nothing else, these two things make such an impact. It's like cool water on a fevered brow. It's just, I can't explain to you the relief that I've seen on kids when I say this to them enough that they finally start to believe it. And I just want to say, as we take this last deep breath, this one last truth that I want to leave you with is that the kids are okay. I mean, deep down, they're struggling. They're birthing a new reality. They're facing unprecedented challenges. But each generation, they become more globally connected. They become less xenophobic, and they become less invested in the idea of separation, despite all the things we hear about them and social media and this and that. They are open and they are ready, and they want to be trusted, and they want to take on these responsibilities. They just need us to believe in them and be part of the solution, be part of their support system, less judgment and more acceptance. And that's difficult for us, because we were not always raised that way. So I want to just leave you with this thought. And I really believe that the kids today will find their way, just like all of us did. And with our help and our willingness to trust in them, they will usher in the change that we all desperately want to see, and that we're here for them. So I'm going to open it up to the question comment period. I'm happy to answer any questions. If you'd like to share your favorite takeaway, you can do that. If you'd like to share your favorite teacher story, you can do that. I appreciate having the time to be with you all today. It was wonderful to see you all. And I'll leave you with this quote from the Dalai Lama: to remember when you're feeling like, I can't possibly make a difference. Yeah, you can. Okay, so should I stop my share now, Renee? We'll go back to the gallery view.
Yeah, if you can stop your share, then we can see everyone's pictures. Switch.
Okay, Renee.
So something I was thinking about, this is actually kind of appropriate timing here with things that we've been discussing at Prairie, is that we're all teachers, but we're all students too, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I think that the reason they're doing fear-mongering is to push people into that panicked zone so that they retreat back into the comfortable zone and people don't try to question or learn things, right? Mm-hmm. And absolutely. The reason they're doing that is so that those in power and status quo maintain the status quo, remain in power, have the money, right? Yeah. So I think this is really important. Something I've been looking into is called logical fallacies.
Yes.
I highly encourage people to look it up. And I wish that all humans were taught these things, because a person can make whatever they say sound so good that you're like, oh yes, that makes total sense. But they're basing it on these logical fallacies. So it's really important to recognize, the media does this a lot. Like Fox News does it a lot, you know? So it's really important to listen to know these things. And I just really want people to, you know, we're all students, and let's keep trying to learn and try not to get pushed into the panic zone and then retreat back into the, well, it's too much, I'm not going to do anything, I'm, you know, zone.
We should absolutely consider a class for our older students on logical fallacies. My son Rowan has a poster on his wall that has the 20 most common logical fallacies. And he constantly, I'll say something, sometimes he's like, that's a logical fallacy. He says it to me all the time. So I think it's fascinating. I think we should put a pin in that idea. And that's, you know, media literacy, civic engagement, the ability, civic discourse, civil discourse. These are all skills that maybe you feel ready to step into. These would be, Prairie would be a wonderful place to talk about these kinds of things. Kathy and Randy. Good to see you guys. But you have to
unmute yourselves.
Yeah.
Oh, good to see you again, Holly. My thought is that I've always felt that smaller class sizes was the underpinning of the thoughts that you have. And I was wondering what your thoughts about small class sizes as reinforcing some of your ideas.
Yeah, I mean, from my earliest days in teaching, I would say all the time, you know, they can give us thousands of dollars for curriculum and supplies, but what they really need to do is give us more teachers, right? Let's just talk about the fact that learning is inherently relational. And when I talk about that, it means I learn best, everybody learns best when they're in a safe relational experience with somebody else, right? And I taught a class of sixth graders where there were 34 of them. It's impossible for me to make a relational connection with 34 different children, many of whom, you know, due to multiple factors, weren't even reading at grade level. You know, I had like 34 sixth graders where maybe three quarters of them were reading fourth grade level or below. So I didn't even have material. So I, not only was I unable to spend the time getting to know them, I was spending a ton of time making sure I had things that they could even read, you know, because I wasn't given the things that I would need. Smaller class sizes are huge. And some of you may know that this, for the second year in a row, our state has a budget surplus, right? Last year, none of that budget surplus went to education. The Republican legislation said, use your one-time COVID funds. to fix all these problems that we all agree are there. And I, on that note, Randy, highly encourage everybody to connect with their elected officials and make it clear that you expect that some of this surplus is going to go into permanent funding for public education, because our teachers are struggling. We are bleeding teachers by the day. They are burning out. They are, you know, and it's not just that they're burning out. Teachers who are burnt out not only can't teach, but they can perpetuate harm unintentionally. And we don't need any more of that. So yeah, smaller class sizes. I'm all for that. I'm all for a fair educational budget. Okay. Thanks, Randy. Yeah. Eileen.
I want to thank you for, I just got lost. Okay. I want to thank you for focusing on the zone of proximal development. I've never heard that outside of educational circles. And I think it's really a revolutionary point. And going back to what Randy was saying, how expecting teachers to do that if they have too many children is completely unrealistic, especially if you're at the elementary level where you're trying to teach six subject matters and to know each child's exactly where they are in learning to do that. And I think that it's one of the reasons that we have so many children who don't learn how to read is because they are at each one of them is at a different level. And if you give it to them, try to stretch them a little bit too much, then they go into that retreat that you talked about, and it's hard to break through that. And then you get bad habits, and the same thing happens with math. The same thing happens with science.
Absolutely.
And the research is very clear that if you have more than 15 children at a young age in a classroom, a teacher cannot get the same progress as they can with a classroom of 15 or under.
And absolutely what you're saying too. I mean, we have to look at the long-term ramifications of pushing kids out of their comfort zone that we are living in right now, right? And you may have all heard of the prison, a school to prison pipeline. Kids that aren't reading at grade level by grade three have a higher incidence of going in, you know, into the prison system at some point. So let's think about, you know, how are we not acknowledging all the inequitable societal factors that might put a kid in a place where they're not ready to read in second grade. They're not ready to be pushed into their challenge zone, and pushing them into their challenge zone is so defeatist. And yet we continue to do it because we have these, frankly, colonialist, honestly rooted in white supremacy ideas about how things should be standardized. Again, that's a conversation for a different day. Am I missing any other hands? Oh, John, Andre.
Hi. I was thinking about how, you know, early in the pandemic, we had to be teachers, you know, from home. And my son, Miles, I think he was in third grade then. He's a fifth grader now. So that seems like my simple math is working on this Sunday morning. but I love what you said about like the comfort zone, challenge zone, and freak out zone. You know, I think of Miles as like a very skilled mathematician, but he was struggling really hard with the concept of symbolism.
Yeah.
And when they were introducing that, I just kept thinking like, man, this seems like a middle school or high schooler concept by like thinking about my own childhood growing up more in the 80s and 90s. So trying to explain to him, you know, he had some piece of work where this dad and son were living inside an airport terminal and they were homeless and some bird was trapped in there. And the question was like, well, how does the bird symbolize, you know, what's going on? And he could not wrap his head around it. And he was in his freak out zone. And just hearing that, I'm like, wow, I really wish I had that kind of tool in my head at the time, because we did have to retreat because there's a lot of tears, a lot of upset moments, trying to understand, hey, there's symbolism here. And I don't know how to get it into your head.
I also want to point you to Eric Erickson's seven stages of psychosocial development in that instance, because that's abstract thinking, right? And kids can't move into abstract thinking before they're ready to move into abstract thinking. Like, they are concrete thinkers for a long time. That's a developmental thing. So put that into your notes. Eric Erickson, he talks about the different stages. You can't move into a new stage until you've successfully mastered the previous stage. And it's very interesting as a parent to look at those stages and see where your kid is. Because it's not necessarily, they're stages, right? So it's not necessarily like a hard, at 7 or 8 years old, they're going to all flip over and suddenly be able to think abstractly. That's not how it works. But again, public education, we really kind of don't embody that understanding. So I highly recommend looking into that. And I would recommend also sharing that observation with your students, teachers, or building administration or curriculum director. Perhaps most importantly, the curriculum director. I think the more information we can give teachers and the more ways we can participate and share our experiences, the better. You know, hopefully you have a very responsive school district, but thanks, John. Evelyn, do we have time for a couple more, Renee? Like two more? I see two more.
Yeah, we can take Evelyn and Dan. Yeah.
Okay, Evelyn and Dan.
Okay. Thank you very much for your talk. It's so clear and nuanced and so forth. So I'm definitely going to listen to the recording again. Jean, my husband and I, we're in Wisconsin from April to October, and we'd like to have some kind of mentoring opportunity. And so I've called the Lucier Center. I haven't heard back from them. I don't know what they do. I don't know whether you'd have any other suggestions. I was also in touch with, I can't remember the name of it now, One World or One Circle. I think it's a school on the east side of town. I kind of prefer the Lucier Center because it's closer to where I work. I could just, where I live, I could just walk there and so forth. But anyway, I would feel it a very profound experience, like the whole mosquito thing, you know, that there's one child that I love to write, I love stories. And so we'd like to interact in that way. Jean's also interested. So if you have something in the chat, you know, of suggestions that we could follow up on, you know, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I actually have a 4-module program that I present to people, different community organizations. I've done it for the Senior Center. I've done it for Mosaicos and other community organizations. It's just a 2-hour training that I do for people to better understand what it might look like to be a tutor or a mentor and understand. I go more in depth into stuff I talked about today, but also give people the skills to feel comfortable to do that virtually. So Lucier Center, I think you should definitely follow up. Give them a list of things you're good at or interested in. I think those kinds of organizations are always looking for volunteers. But I'm also happy at some point to come back and talk to everybody about this kind of idea of like, how could you possibly fit maybe some virtual mentoring into your life? Because education is the great equalizer and tutors are expensive and hard to find. And we all know that it is not it's not equitable. There's many children will never, ever have access to a tutor. And so the challenge is not only getting more people to flood the market and feel comfortable with those skills, but also finding a central hub where people can call and say, that people across cultures can trust and has developed some trust. My kid is struggling. Do you have some resource? And frankly, I don't see why Prairie couldn't be a place like that, right? Where in my old district, there was somebody maintained a list of people, names, phone numbers, emails, what they were willing to tutor and mentor. And people could just click on that, ask for that list and get the help that their kid needs. Because so many kids, especially kids who have been disadvantaged by an inequitable system, don't have access to that. And we need to build up the trust for many families to come forward and ask for that help. And they don't always know how to do that. So thank you, Evelyn. And I'm happy you can email me anytime. I'm happy to give you more information about or help you find an opportunity for that, because I think we need more people doing that. Dan.
Yeah, that was the same topic that I wanted to talk about. I was a tutor, a volunteer teacher aide, I suppose you'd say, for the public schools in my neighborhood. And I think it was through an organization called City Cities of Hope or something like that. It was not part of the school district per se, but we worked with the school district, and I was used as to tutor math and reading. It was very rewarding experience, and I, you know, mostly one-on-one, so yeah. It really made a difference for the kids I worked with. And I don't know how hard it is to get into a position like that, like how we can get into the classrooms and make a difference with the teachers, because they really needed, you know, they needed another adult in the room.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is one option. And I want to also just, again, press on the idea that if you have a couple of hours in the evening, I still, 3 nights a week, I work with elementary school students, with helping them with math and reading, and their parents are, you know, so desperate, just helping them with homework. It's not just the kid you're helping, it's overworked parents who really don't know what to do and also need a break, right? So again, I'm interested in some point in talking more about the program that I have. It just goes through like different technological issues that you might have, how to share your screen, tools you can use, free resources online, just so much stuff. And I think I invite you all to think about how you might at some point consider virtual mentoring, because kids these days are very comfortable with technology. And not to say that you shouldn't go into the schools and try that, but if COVID's stopping you from that, there are other options. And I just want to put that out there, because we can reach more people and we can be much more accessible and inclusive and equitable in our thinking if we expand it a little bit. So I think that's probably where we're going to pause the questions. I am so grateful to you all for listening. This is a topic that is first and foremost in my mind. As I said in my intro, I see teaching as a calling. I feel so grateful to be able to do this work. And I'm so grateful to have shared it all with you today.
All right. So now we'll have our closing words that are by Margaret Mead, read by Holly.
You probably saw this in my email signature. If you ever read an email from me as DRE, it was always at the bottom. And it said, never doubt that a small group of committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
Next, we'll have the closing music, The Little Wanderer, performed by Amber. Now going to stop the recording, and then we'll move into Joy's concerns and welcoming visitors.